Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Using a gun and handcuffs, Robert Nordlander chased tax evaders and money launderers around the world for the Internal Revenue Service. So considering that it's tax time now, he's our guest on the Lean to the Left podcast and the Justice Counts podcast. And we're going to talk about taxes, audits, avoiding trouble with the IRS, and a lot more. So stay with us.
Welcome to Lean to the Left, home of no-holds-barred commentary, plus interviews with fascinating people, some of them top experts, others simply with interesting stories to tell. You'll never know who'll show up at Lean to the Left. Now here's your host, Bob Gatti.
As an IRS criminal investigation special agent, Robert Nordlander was a highly trained federal agent who spent over 20 years chasing tax evaders and money launderers across the globe. His investigations ranged from simple embezzlement to cryptocurrency to using foreign trusts to hide income. He's traveled to various countries on behalf of the United States, training other countries' federal investigators. Nordlander's specialty is following the money, whether in a divorce, partnership dispute, stealing inheritances, or in criminal court. He also helps defense attorneys in criminal tax investigations and is an expert in how to deal with the IRS with unpaid taxes. He's an Amazon best-selling author, having written two books, Criminal Tax Secrets, What Every Defense Attorney Should Know, and Unpaid Payroll Taxes, A Time Bomb You Can Defuse. Nordlander is a licensed CPA and a certified fraud examiner. He also hosts two podcasts, Fraud Fighter Podcast, which is about the forensic accounting and anti-fraud, anti-money laundering industry, and Criminal Tax Files, which is about criminal tax investigations. Robert, thanks for being with Mark Bellow and me on the podcast today. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much, Bob. And Mark, I appreciate it.
All right. Hey, before we get into specific tax issues, I'd like to know what you think about the Republican plan to, in effect, defund the Internal Revenue Service and replace the income tax with a 30% national sales tax.
The issue is that there has to be...
It wasn't 30%, was it?
Yes, it's 30%.
30? Okay. All right.
30 seems a little high to me, but that's...
Yeah, me too.
If you want to quibble, it depends on how it is figured out. But the high number that the Democrats are using to blast the Republicans with is 30%.
Okay.
Okay. All right. The issue is that there's a price to pay for a civilized society, and that's some type of tax system. Back in the day, it was stamp taxes and excise taxes, and then later on became an income tax, and then income taxes now, and Social Security taxes are what really fund the government these days. So there has to be someone who has to collect the taxes. The question is who and how we're going to do it. The Internal Revenue Service right now is the tax collector for the federal government, of course, and they're charged with assessing and making sure people pay their fair share or what's owed. And you can't have an organization like that without being funded. It's just a matter of, we have a voluntary compliance system, which means people self-assess their taxes by filing a tax return. You either get a refund or they owe. And someone's got to go out there and do that work. So for the government, whether it's Congress, Republicans, or Democrats, to defund the IRS, who's going to collect the tax is the first thing. And I would dare say that the way the tax code is written and why Congress has done what they've done, they've got to have at least a bare minimum to operate this country by collecting the taxes. And I don't believe defunding the IRS is going to be the answer. Because if you defund the IRS, who's going to collect the taxes? And we work on a system of, frankly, of putting the fear of God in people to pay the taxes. Because the IRS does have a lot of power, which does not need to go through the court system in order to collect those taxes. And once people understand the IRS is defanged, then people are not going to pay. It's bad enough as it is now with people not with cheating on their taxes. It'd be much worse if folks know that the IRS is just not going to have any power to collect those taxes. So that's the first thing. The second thing regarding the Republican, what we call national sales tax, I personally am a believer of the national sales tax. I think it'd be a lot easier system to do. And this is my personal opinion, of course. It is a way. Now, the question would be the percentages, the devil's in the details. But every state that I know of has a sales tax system. And if the IRS can somehow, some way, figure out a way, or Congress figure out a way where they can piggyback on the state sales tax system and have a federal sales tax system in this work, I would be actually for it. You would have less of an IRS need, and then you have more of the counties and the state governments collecting these taxes, and they're collecting the federal taxes on behalf of the U.S. government. Get a small slice of it for their troubles and send the money up to the federal government. I personally think it's a better idea versus all this other stuff of income taxes and who gets to earn income tax credit and all these, I think, what I call social engineering when it comes to these taxes, because let's face it, Congress makes these laws, wants to benefit certain things, which is okay. You've got kids, you get certain deductions. You go to education, you get certain deductions. You have a business, you get certain deductions. All that stuff can go out the window, and all you would have to deal with is just a sales tax issue. I personally like the idea of it. It's not going to go very far at all. There's too much at stake. But the theory behind it, I'm actually all for.
So you like the idea of replacing the income tax with the national sales tax. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly what you're hearing. Okay. When you think about it, many state and counties already do this. Mm-hmm. You have, even I know in North Carolina, you have a real estate tax, right? You have a property tax. And the county will actually look at the property tax and assess it, but the county also collects on behalf of the city. So you have a city tax and a county tax. But the county is going to get a certain percentage of that money from the city for their hassle, but the city gets their money. So it's the same valuation of real estate, and there's a city county, there's a city tax and a county tax, but you got one entity collecting it, but they're dispersing it. And I think actually it's more efficient if you do the same concept with the states. Let the states handle it and then turn the money over, but let them, I know there's maybe a constitutional issue about telling states what to do on behalf of the federal government, but let the states get a part of that sales tax. Let them go and enforce it. You know, I think it'd be a lot easier.
I actually agree with you. It also creates a system where everybody pays taxes. The biggest criticism right now of our current system is that this group of people doesn't pay taxes. This group of people does. A person who makes a small income is paying 20-30%. But a billionaire pays nothing. It would take all of that away. I don't know how you calculate what a national sales tax would look like, but I certainly like the concept.
Makes that a lot easier too. All these accounting, I know TurboTax and all these people will be upset. H&R Block, they would all be upset because they're out of business, right? But then you can focus more on listen, there is a sales tax already system already in place. Add whatever federal tax on top of that, whatever the rate is, and then go with it. You could literally have 50 IRS employees, one IRS employee responsible for each state for collecting the taxes and make sure the state is in compliance. In that type of system, you would already have that, the way you can be lean on the tax collection and then let the states deal with the fallout if there's issues.
I suppose there's a suggestion that it would have economic consequences, where if you're trying to sell something and you're adding a buck or two in taxes to the sale, that will somehow depress sales, for lack of a better way to say, would choose not to buy because it costs more money.
But is that really a shell game? They're already taking the taxes out anyways.
Yeah, I mean, no, I hear you.
I'm already having my taxes, let's say 10%, 20% already taken out to begin with. I'm just now getting less money to pay for it. I think people would be more cognizant of the tax code if they knew, oh, great, my sales tax went up another 1%, 2%. What in the world Congress is doing with my money?
Everybody who buys pays. That's what I like about it.
That's what I like about it too, honestly. And when you think about a progressive tax code, just something to think about. Let's assume that bread costs, let's say, a dollar, right? I know it doesn't cost a dollar, but let's assume it costs a dollar. So it has to be cost a dollar out of someone's pocket. If someone's in the 10% tax bracket, they have to make $1.10 to pay the $0.10 tax, so they get a dollar. So they can buy the bread. Now, if someone's in the 20% tax bracket or 30% tax bracket or 50% tax bracket, whatever that is, they have to make $1.50 to buy a dollar bread. Is it really fair for someone who has to make more money in order to pay for the same product that somebody else does? It's a philosophical and social discussion. But when you have a progressive tax bracket, people who make more money have to pay more taxes. So ultimately, the cost of that bread that they're buying is higher than anybody else.
Well, the criticism of the current code politically is that the larger income people are paying less taxes, not more.
I would dare say I don't think that's really honestly true in some ways. If you want to take the Social Security tax out of it, I don't think it's really true. I've been doing tax returns for over 20 something years. I've seen every strata of social economic system out there. The people making $50,000, $60,000 a year are not paying any federal income tax whatsoever. They're not paying it because they don't owe it. Anything above and beyond that, they owe. Now, Social Security tax is a different animal altogether because you do get the money, in theory, later on down the life, even though we have a system where we pay now and there's no money, there's no pot of money sitting out there waiting for you. It's just an IOU. But you take Social Security tax out of the equation, I don't know. The federal income tax code, people are paying a higher share of it. There's a progressive tax code that we have. So I personally like the national sales tax issue. I just like it because I think it's fair. And even if we go back to and some people don't like this from a religious standpoint, when you go back to the very earliest tax systems in the Old Testament, of a 10%, what they call tithe, everybody paid their fair share, whether it's the richest guy in the country or the poorest person, they still had to pay their percentage, and that was it. And they also had their own how to pay for the poor people and that type of stuff. But the point being is that everybody had to pay something into the system.
How do you feel about the flat tax as opposed to a progressive tax?
I like the flat tax. Make things simple.
You prefer sales tax to flat tax to sales tax?
I think a sales tax is a flat tax.
That's true.
It's just a question of at what point of collection are you doing it? Are you doing it on an income level or on a consumption level? And the sales tax would be on a consumption level. Which personally, if I earned $100 and I decided to save it and invest it and I don't want to spend it, that's my prerogative. I want to spend $110 and go buy a car or whatever else I'm going to buy, then I'll pay the national sales tax or whatever else it is. I'm okay with that.
So you prefer the sales to the flat income tax?
I would, but my second one would be a flat tax. It's a lot easier that way.
I want to discuss your forensics career.
Sure.
From a political standpoint, you've got Trump's accountant going to jail, but Trump is free. The accountant who does his taxes goes to prison. The person who files and signs the return doesn't. As a fraud fighter, do you see culpability for him and his children or others in his organization?
Let me do one little caveat. I'm only reading the headlines and reading a couple of the paragraphs. I'm not sitting in the courtroom and really delving into the situation. But knowing
nor am I.
Knowing what I know about the court system and how it's operated and doing forensic investigations into organizations like this, it's not uncommon. Number one is the CFO or whoever's writing out the checks, doing the fraud, they're the ones going to prison. Now, the question is going to be, is the return preparer, does the return preparer know about the fraud and how much culpability do they have in that situation? It looks like to me, I say looks, because I'm not behind the scenes, that they, being the prosecutors, whether it's federal or state, do not believe that the return preparers knew of the fraud going on. If they knew of the fraud, they'd be a different story altogether. But telling a return preparer, here's my expenses, here's my income, and they just fill out the form, there's no willfulness on their part of committing some type of tax crime. Same thing with the owners. If the owners, let's say the owners is Trump or anybody else in general, they also wouldn't be held culpable if somebody else was embezzling either. Now, you may say there should be some due diligence, you should ask more questions, and that would be for any business, whether it's Trump or not. It looks like to me like the system worked. If the accountant was falsifying invoices, doing things he shouldn't be doing, lying, those type of overt willfulness acts of tax evasion, then they should be punished for it.
Okay. We talked through the issue of the national sales tax and a flat tax. Is that your solution, you think, to get everybody to pay their fair share of taxes?
When we define fair share, how are we defining fair? And that's the question from a point of view. My version of fair is everybody pays a certain percentage and that's it. That's my version of fair. Some people's versions of fair is if you're rich, however you define rich, you should be paying more taxes and percentage-wise than somebody else. If you really want to be fair, you take the total amount of taxes that should be collected and divide it equally among everybody. That would be fair. I think everybody would like that, because the people's income probably can't afford it. So we go with the percentage method, which was like based upon the Old Testament system of a percentage method of the income tax. That's how I would look at it. But it depends. When you say the word fair, people have a different version of what fair is. My version is a flat tax, in a sense, or a flat sales tax.
Everybody paying the fair the same percentage. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay.
And I tell you what this also would do. People get upset that, and I see this in nationwide publications, oh, the poor people are getting audited more than the rich people. Okay? Hear that quite often. Why is it? First of all, they have to understand it's because the poor people are getting tax credits, which means by being poor, the IRS is giving them money. Not that they earn the money or do a refund. They're getting money for being poor. Now, that's something that we decided to do as a society. Okay, fine. But the amount of fraud that goes on in order to get those people into that category of quote unquote working poor is just unbelievable. You take that tax credit away, okay, you don't have fraud down to those lower levels, because people who are making $40,000, $60,000 a year are not paying a federal income tax to begin with. And the only reason why people who are getting audited, they're making less than that, is because of the false tax credits that they're receiving. That's how it works. So a lot of this fraud that goes on, frankly, is from those lower levels because it's free money.
When you talk about taxes, whether you're talking about the poor or the rich, I've been around a long time and I've been rich and poor and I've benefited from being rich and I've benefited from being poor. Now I'm a senior on Social Security and I benefit from that. Although you could argue that I paid into the system and I deserve it.
Right.
It was quote, my money, unquote. But am I dreaming or are there any sensible suggestions that you would have, whether it's supporting the poor or supporting the wealthy? Politics enter into the tax code all the time. This politician supporting rich constituents wants this tax benefit to the code because he got a great contribution from somebody wealthy, or that politician wants a handout for the poor for this reason or that reason. What if we took political giveaways out of the tax code? What would it look like? The flat tax?
Probably. I guess the question would be, is the devil's in the details. What do you mean by political giveaways? I don't know exactly. Give me an example of a political giveaway.
A tax credit for buying an electric car.
Okay. That would be, I don't know if that's considered a political giveaway or incentive. I would agree there should be no tax credit for getting an electric car.
A tax credit for child care. That's both sides of that issue.
Sure. Me personally, I would say none of it. But that's just me. Just do a flat tax and be done with it. If you've got five kids, you got five kids. If you've got five kids and three of them are in child care, you got five kids and three of them are in child care. That's your prerogative as an individual. You're making those decisions in a lot of ways.
My question, though, is politically, do you see any of that being possible? There always seems to be some political reason for a handout on either the top level of income or the lowest level of income.
As long as Congress is going to play games like this, you're going to have a code like this. And that's what makes it so frustrating for most people is that, oh, I don't qualify this year because I make too much money. Yes, I don't. Oh, I bought this car. Do I get this? And it's just ridiculous. If you had a flat tax or a sales tax and no tax credits, period, it makes life a lot easier. Yeah. For everybody, I think. But you're right. There are incentives or de-incentives, depending on how you look at it, of certain activities that the Congress has decided that are beneficial for society in general. And that's how they fix it. I personally wouldn't do it that way, but I'm not in Congress.
I wish you were.
I was at one time, I was a city councilman back way, way back when I was in my young days. And I had this quote, and I think I ticked a lot of people off. I said, every year we play Santa Claus and every year we have to carry a bigger sled. If you're going to play Santa Claus, the sled has to get bigger and bigger every year. This is ridiculous. Why are we giving money away to this arts program and this nonprofit and this everything else? People got their hands out, all this type of garbage. We shouldn't be in the business of redistributing money. We should be in the business of collecting the income taxes or collecting the taxes, period, from the property taxes, some sales tax issues, in providing service of fire, the streets and the garbage and that type of thing. We should not be in the business of redistributing this money to other quote unquote good agencies that help our society. I'm a capitalist at heart. If it works, you win. If it doesn't work, you lose. Ultimately, society will determine if the museum, the art museum or anything else should be out there. Or the light, or how big, you know, this, I'll give an example, these fine art agencies that they had, or anti-poor stuff, or maybe not anti-poor, or just they want to lose a swimming pool somewhere else, help fund this. No, it's not my job to fund that stuff. Walt Disney World is just fine without me.
On the other side of that, deductions. Some wealthy billionaire deducts his Maserati because he drives it for business. I know it's a facetious example, but there is some expanded political thought regarding what is a business deduction and what is not. Yes?
The IRS, and by default, Congress, has determined that a deduction has to be reasonable, okay, and necessary. Now, you define what's reasonable and necessary in one way. Somebody might define reasonable and necessary in ordinary another way. But every business is different. If I'm in the business of renting out my Maserati because I want to rent out my Maserati to people who like to drive around Maseratis, let them do it if it's reasonable and necessary. The same thing, I'm a barber. What's reasonable and necessary is different than what's, you know, a car dealership or a doctor. But they're allowed to deduct these reasonable and necessary expenses. And they should be. Personally, I don't care if a rich person depreciates his Maserati or not. You bought the car. You want to use it for business. You want to depreciate it based upon the laws. Go right ahead. I have a Toyota Camry. It's probably worth $5,000. It's probably not worth depreciating and all that, which is fine. But I don't begrudge someone who's made a lot of money, more than likely, almost always, legitimately, by providing some type of service. Bill Gates is worth $1 billion or billions of dollars because he provided. These people that are quote unquote rich typically have done something for society that people enjoy their product or services. And Capitalism 101 says they're worth a lot more because they provided more services for us. I like it that way. I like having my Xbox, whatever else it is, Apple phone. I'm okay with it. I like it. And if they get certain deductions, they get certain deductions. But they shouldn't get any more deductions legally than the plumber down the street either. That's the issue.
Yeah, it certainly is.
But they're in a different industry too.
Most of us are in the process of preparing our tax returns between now and April, let's say. How do we avoid getting in trouble with the IRS and avoid being chased by the nasty IRS agent out there?
Like him.
What are your recommendations?
Like these guys, like Nordlander. That's who we don't want to be chasing. I don't think if I saw that guy coming, man, I'd run. Jeez, oh, flip.
He scares the hell out of me.
Yeah, he scares the hell out of me, too. After this short break, we'll hear what advice Robert Nordlander has for us so we don't get into trouble with the IRS.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
There is a proverb in the Bible that says, the wicked flee with no man pursues.
All I know is I don't want him looking over my taxes when I deduct the $500 that I spend on promoting my podcast, for which I get no money.
No, I completely understand it. The issue is that there's two things that we're talking about, and I want to make sure that we don't confuse the two. Number one is there is a civil function of the IRS, and that function is to assess the taxes and collect the taxes. And we have a system where individuals or corporations self-assess their tax liability and then report that information to the IRS. The best way to stay out of civil trouble is just by filing First Truth and Honest and file it on time and accurately. That's really, there's always going to be some mistakes here where maybe you forget something, that it happens. And then you'll get one of those nasty letters from the IRS. Excuse me, you sold some stock and you didn't report it. Okay, fine. Then you have the other issue of the bucket of people who intentionally don't want to pay what is due. Now, the law does not separate between $1 of evading a taxes or $1 billion. There's no dollar amount in the statute. It just says if you evade taxes, you are guilty and you can be sentenced up to 5 years in prison. So there's no dollar amount associated with that. But from a practical standpoint, the IRS does have to make a decision. Federal prosecutors do have to make a decision about who should be prosecuted and who should not be prosecuted. And most of the time, it's based upon the tax loss, how much damage was done to society in general based upon this person's actions. They owed $100,000 in tax. They didn't pay for it, not because they couldn't pay for it, but because they intentionally lied, hide, deceit, all that type of stuff, what we call willfulness. They should go to prison. And there's a system to do that. So for the most people who actually are filing tax returns and being reasonable in their income, I'll say reasonable, they're not going to have any problems. Most folks out there are W-2 earners, and it's hard to cheat on your taxes when you're a W-2 earner. The tax has already been taken out for the most part of your paychecks. You have a standard deduction that's higher now than it was a couple of years ago. There's not really much you can do to cheat on your taxes in that situation. Most of the cheating goes either from the tax credit standpoint, where people say, I don't have enough money, I'm working poor, or I went to school and you didn't go to school, the education credits. That's where a lot of this, some of the fraud goes. Or it's small businesses, self-employed individuals who either are not reporting all their income or deducting things that frankly are just false. Those type of people need to be investigated and prosecuted, those who willfully do things. So dealing with me as a criminal investigator, it was those people who deserved to go to prison. Those are the ones who actually wanted to go because they were so blatant in their activity that you had to stop them. But the individual who transposes a number and puts down 96 versus 69, forgets something small here and there, a little bit of interest income, that's just, it is what it is. There's no criminal intent there.
But there's also, is there not a level of you get audited, you've done something wrong, even if you've done it deliberately, there's a level at which if you cooperate and you create a schedule or a repayment schedule or what have you, they'd rather get the tax dollars than put you in prison. Is that so or not so?
That is true. That is absolutely true. That if there is a mistake that you didn't intentionally do anything wrong, you just screwed it all up. There's an element where the IRS wants to figure out how much you owe and then develop some type of payment plan or payment system to where they get their money back, plus probably penalties and interest and all that type of thing. Then there's the element of you did something wrong and you intentionally did something wrong, but you got caught. Now, is it still a crime? Yes. But for the most part, the IRS wants to get you back into how much do you really owe? Let's get a payment plan. Let's penalize you and put some interest to it. And then let's get you back into the fold.
That's their preference, isn't it?
Versus... That would be their preference, yes. Because frankly, you can't put every tax cheat in prison, number one. But number two is the ultimate goal is to get the money. So that's, you would be right. Now, when it comes to bigger amounts, now that becomes the question of what do we do with this guy who just doesn't just owe the IRS $5,000, he owes the IRS $500,000. We as a society have determined that type of person needs to be made an example out of. And that's what the IRS looks for, is for those individuals who have higher amounts, let's say six figures, and tax due and owing, that they can put literally, in a sense, constitutionally applicable, put their head on a stick in front of the courthouse and say, don't be this guy. Because they want to make national news out of it. They want to do a press release saying this guy did all this bad stuff. The government $500,000 in taxes. He's going to go to prison for 3 or 4 years, and he's going to owe the money anyways. Don't be this person. There is an element of fear that the IRS wants to put into the average taxpayer. So they have confidence that the system works.
So if we're audited, how does that get turned into a criminal investigation?
if you are audited, like I said, there is an element, what they call willfulness.
All right.
And the auditors are trained. And most of the times, the issue is not the audit, but the collection of the tax. You can be audited and say, hey, you deducted something you shouldn't have deducted. You owe now, let's say, $100,000 in tax. Okay. So the IRS says you owe $100,000, and then they'll start doing the collection activity. They send you the nasty letters. They threaten to levy your assets, the liens on your property. They threaten to sell your children. And they do all this stuff, right, to get you to get into some type of payment plan. Where most of the fraud occurs when it comes from a civil to a criminal is not in the audit stage. It's in the collection stage. Because once the IRS says you owe the $100,000 and they try to collect it, that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where people start saying, oh, don't pay me, pay my wife the money. Oh, let me put this asset in my girlfriend's name because I don't want the IRS to seize it and to sell it. That's where a lot of those crimes happen. From a civil to a criminal issue. It's not really the audit, it's the collection of the payment, because that's easier to prove willfulness. It's hard to prove willfulness. It's not impossible, but it's harder to prove willfulness if there's an audit and let's say you depreciate something over 5 years and it should have been 7. So what? It's a small issue. The IRS does a little tax computation and say, oh, you now owe us money. That's hard to prove willfulness. But if someone's always not reporting the income, putting the money in someone else's name, that type of thing, that becomes more willful, as well as over years. The IRS criminal investigations don't do typically 1 year tax cases. They'll do a 4 year, 5 year tax case. And the reason being is because at the end of the day, your audience is 10 people or 12 people in a jury box who may or may not have college educations, that have to sit there and say guilty or not guilty. And they're going to look at the facts as a whole and think whether or not this person should go to prison for the tax evasion. They're not going to put someone in tax prison because they made a mistake. Nobody wants to be in that situation. So when the IRS criminal side looks at tax cases, they're looking at through the view, the lens of a normal citizen who is out there in the streets, who's sitting in a jury box, needs to understand that this defendant did it year one, year two, year three, year four, year five. And when they got caught, they hid the money here. They put the money here. They did this here. And it wasn't $10. It was $10,000, $10 million, whatever else it is. The jury's going to look at them going, yes, I'm pissed off at that person. I'm going to find them guilty. And that's the type of cases they're looking for. They're not looking for the honest mistakes or even okay. The low dollar value amounts.
Does the IRS have different classifications of taxes that are more likely, for lack of a better way to say it, to trigger an audit or a criminal investigation? For instance, if a payroll tax, for instance, is considered a trust account, as I understand it, tax,
yes.
It goes into a trust fund. So a small business gets into some financial trouble. They have a bank loan that they have to pay, and they're balancing a low cash flow, and they say the bank's going to foreclose on the loan if we don't pay them. On the other hand, I owe my payroll taxes. I choose to pay the bank loan and delay the payroll taxes, and they get into a situation where they delay the payroll taxes a bit longer than the IRS would like them to. Is that an example of a tax that the IRS cracks down on, or are there priority taxes versus non-priority tax? How does that work?
No, it's a good question. There is a high percentage of what's collected in the U.S. government is from payroll taxes. Whether it's federal income taxes and Social Security, I think it's 80% of all the revenue that comes into the U.S. government is from either federal income taxes or Social Security income tax or Social Security taxes. That is a huge amount of money. Congress has established laws that states that employers are required to withhold federal income taxes and Social Security taxes out of people's paychecks. the Congress has also established a law that says that when an employer is required to do, they're holding this money in trust, which means, like what you said, they're holding it on behalf of the government and are required to turn it over to the government at particular times, whether it's quarterly, weekly, whatever, based upon the amount. The IRS and the, especially Congress, considers that as theft of their money when the money's not turned over at the proper time or collected. So that's how they look at it. And because there's a huge percentage of the revenue that comes into the U.S. government is from these types of taxes, they will crack down on that one a little harder than just regular income taxes. And the reason being is because of this. It doesn't, number one, they consider it theft because you took it out of people's paychecks and didn't turn it over. Number two is the amount of money grows extremely high very fast. If you've got one or two employees, it's not that much money. You end up getting 100 employees, 200 employees, 50 employees. Boy, you start multiplying $10,000 per person times 50, you're getting a lot of money really quick on a yearly basis. And so that $500,000 becomes $1 million next year, 1.5 the year after that. It just explodes.
And they add penalties, don't they?
And they add penalties, true to that. From a criminal standpoint, we don't look at the penalty side of it. We look at the base amount of the money that was withheld, the employment taxes. So employment taxes are considered a higher priority than just a regular income tax in general. Just for various reasons. Number one is it's a high percentage of income or requirement for the government to operate. And then number two is, if you don't get a hold of this pretty quick, it's just going to explode and it gets big really quick. And that's kind of where the money's at, honestly, is the payroll tax problems. Because like you said, it's held in trust. It's the government's money. It's not being turned over. It's one thing to owe money. It's another thing to take somebody's money and not turn it over. And employment taxes is considered taking the government's money and not turning it over.
Not just the government. Your employees.
Yeah, you're stealing money from your employees, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ultimately, it's the government's money, but it's on behalf of that employee. The Social Security, you're right, is the government's money, but it's held in supposedly in trust on behalf of that employee. And at the end of the day, the IRS has to give credit, or the Social Security Administration has to give credit to that employee because they earned the money. It just happened the employer just stole it or didn't turn it over. So the government doesn't even get the money, and then the government at the end of the day has to pay that money out later on. So it's a double whammy.
Yeah. So if I go to my tax accountant and I provide that individual with my information and the tax accountant files the returns based on that information, some of which was false, could that tax accountant get in trouble?
When you say trouble, you mean civilly or criminally?
Criminally.
Criminally, the answer is no, because there's no willful act to file a false tax return. If they're being lied to and they just fill out the form not knowing they've been lied to, then there's no willfulness on their part to commit a crime.
Okay. What about civil?
Civilly, they may be able to be in trouble because they didn't ask the right questions.
Okay.
I'll give an example. We're talking about the earned income tax credit and those tax credits for the working poor. The government has required the return preparer to ask certain questions and to get certain documentation in order to prove that they qualify for this. If that return preparer did not do that, then they can be held civilly liable for certain penalties because they didn't ask the right questions.
Oh, I see.
So in that situation, they would be because their due diligence was not there. But if the return, on the flip side, let's say the return preparer asked the right questions and they were given false documents. They can't be in trouble for that because they were bamboozled like the government was bamboozled.
From a legal standpoint, Bob, they have to be complicit.
That's right. There has to be some type of willfulness intent to defraud somebody.
Okay.
Going back to the trust funds that we talked about with payroll tax, and any other tax bill that you have. I know there's a lot of businesses out there that advertise, we can, if you owe a lot of money to the IRS, we can do this or we can do that, or we can lower the amount you have to pay. Is that a typical thing? Can you negotiate with the IRS if you have a big tax bill? And if
yes,
and if you can, is there a tax that you owe that you can't negotiate? Is like the trust funds we talked about?
Oh, good question. All right. Here's a situation. The IRS is been authorized by Congress to collect and assess the taxes. There are certain situations where people just can't pay, whether it's through bankruptcy or something else. For some reason, these people just can't pay. Congress has given the IRS the authority to negotiate tax debts, but then the IRS can make up their own rules about how they're going to negotiate this. So Congress says, you are allowed, and there's a statute out there, it says IRS will be allowed to negotiate tax debts. The U.S. Treasury will determine how to negotiate it. So it's based upon the IRS and the Secretary of the Treasury to figure out what qualifies as being negotiable and how they're going to do that. So the IRS makes their own rules up. In that situation, the IRS does. So there are various ways to negotiate tax debts. The most common one is the pennies on the dollar. You're sitting there late night TV and you got somebody playing on the golf course saying, all right, for $1,000, I got $1 million negotiated out of the way. And then you got these predatory, I call them predatory, tax resolution firms that prey on these individuals, but they know what the IRS rules are. And the IRS has certain rules and they have it in their manual about what qualifies for negotiation and how to do this. So if you know those rules, you can negotiate your tax debt. And there's various ways of looking at it. There's probably like 6 or 7 different ways to negotiate a tax debt. But the pennies on the dollar is really the main one. Most of the time, people would qualify what we call an installment plan. Just like you have a car, you buy a car, you owe the bank $20,000 for the loan of the car, and the bank says, well, it's going to be $500 a month for so many years. The IRS has got the same type of thing. They have an installment plan.
Trust funds too?
Trust funds can be installment plans too as well. But the trust funds are considered if, it's a little more of a technical question, Mark. The trust fund, if an individual is been penalized with what they call a trust fund recovery penalty. So you have a business owner who's been personally assessed this tax because the government says this is a penalty. That trust fund can be negotiated, but it can't be bankruptible. It's one of those weird things. You can't just bankrupt it, but it can be negotiated with the IRS. But there's rules and regulations about what qualifies. And the IRS, if you think about it, has to take into consideration every social economic situation out there. So someone in San Francisco has the same benefit as someone in Idaho and someone in Miami. So they look at where you're living at. Okay. They look at how many kids or how many dependents you have, what medical expenses your children have or dependents. You may have a father that's responsible for your father, and they have to take consideration who's responsible, who's making the money, how much money they're making, what their normal expenses are, who's in their family household, where they're living at. They take all these things into consideration. And then you can figure out whether or not you can negotiate your tax bill somehow, some way. There's no straight answer for this is what works, but there's a formula in which they look at to determine what they'll accept. And the bottom line is that you can negotiate your tax debt for pennies on the dollar. It's true, but you have to be almost bankruptable. You almost have to be bankrupt in order to do it. The IRS is not just going to forgive your tax debt because you look pretty.
They would negotiate the penalty before they would negotiate the tax owed, right? Correct?
Correct. And there's rules and regulations regarding negotiating penalties as well. But yes, but people don't understand is that this pennies on the dollar stuff, and this is the common one, is the IRS is going to figure out how much your net assets are, what are you worth, and what's your reasonable income going to be for the next 12 months. And they'll take all that. So if you have $100,000 in equity in your house and you owe $50,000, the IRS is not going to negotiate the $50,000. You have $100,000 you can borrow on your house. So you're out of luck.
It's almost like a Chapter 13 or a Chapter 11 bankruptcy evaluation, isn't it?
It's exactly what you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah.
It's exactly almost the same process. They will allow certain small things, but for the most part, you have to have no assets and very little income to negotiate the stuff away.
If you could talk a little bit about your criminal tax secrets book, what's it cover? Who's it meant for?
Oh, I appreciate you letting me talk about this. I spent over 20 years with the IRS chasing tax evaders and money launderers around the globe. And I put all my wit and wisdom, hopefully wit and wisdom, into a book called Criminal Tax Secrets, What Every Defense Attorney Should Know. And it's to help them understand what questions to ask, what documents to request to get their client the best deal possible. You can't change the facts of the case. But maybe the IRS messed up in their calculations, or maybe they didn't ask the right questions, or maybe there's no willfulness, those types of things. So it's really to help defense attorneys understand behind the scenes how decisions are made and to where they can get their client the best deal possible. Their client may be guilty of sin, and maybe they owe $100,000. Then let's figure out the best way to get in good graces of the judge in order to say that we're sorry, and say, mea culpa, we're sorry, we're not going to do it again. Maybe that's the answer to that question. Or maybe the IRS says you owe $100,000 and you really only owe 80 because the IRS screwed up. But the judge says, no, you're guilty of 80, but not 100. So the judge can sentence you to 80, not 100. So the book is really to help them evaluate the cases and know what documents to get and what questions to ask to make sure that all the facts are known. That's all.
Okay, is that book helpful, useful to the average taxpayer, or is it really only meant for lawyers?
The audience intended is for lawyers, but anyone who's in the business, like a small business or a return preparer or CPA, would find it helpful to see how the IRS goes from a civil issue to a criminal issue. And then once it becomes a criminal issue, how they make these decisions, that type of thing. But the book is really tailored toward attorneys who understand federal court and the federal court system, because I'm assuming I can't go into what's pro bono means and what these other words mean. They may have to look some things up, but it's written for an attorney, but it's on a fifth grade level. Yeah, you just have to understand that I'm assuming certain things, that certain knowledge about what an expert is and what qualifies as evidence, that type of thing.
Where can people find your book?
Oh, Amazon. They can go to Amazon. It's solely on Amazon right now. It's a Kindle and paperback. Okay. I would highly recommend those who are professionals like CPAs, enrolled agents, attorneys, buy a hardback copy or a paperback copy, because it's more of a reference than it is a feel-good romance novel. This is not Mark Bellow's fiction novels where you can read it on Kindle and enjoy it and say, okay, thank you for the next book. This one here you may want to take off the shelf if there's ever a question.
Thank you for the shameless plug.
Yeah, no problem, Mark.
There's a guy in Michigan by the name of Levy who does tax negotiations. I just crack up every time. He runs ads on TV, and he uses his last name as a business tool. It's pretty funny. You run a forensic accounting and tax resolution firm, correct? Are you retired?
I retired from the IRS 2 years ago. After you put 20 years in, you can have some benefits and retire. So I decided it didn't pay to stay. So I decided to go ahead and leave and just start a forensic accounting tax resolution practice. The skill set that I had, what can I do in the private sector? So I went ahead and left the IRS and decided to start my own firm.
So this guy I'm talking about who does tax resolutions, that's exactly what you guys do. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yep. So my experience with the IRS, I thought that maybe I'd have a leg up of understanding what goes behind the scenes. And many times the people that I negotiate with, I know.
I didn't mean to pitch your competitor. Sorry.
No, it's all good. But to resolve, because of my forensic accounting, which means accounting in court, following the money, that skill set, and then my skill set with knowing the IRS, I decided to open up a CPA firm that focuses on forensic accounting, and which is follow the money, as well as solving people's tax problems. I don't do tax returns. I don't do the bookkeeping system of it. My job is to, you're in big trouble, either with the federal government, or you're trying to follow the money, or you owe the IRS a lot of money. I'm hired to help solve the problem and get them back on their merry way.
For both people and business?
Yes.
Okay. Do you do radio and TV ads to bring in business?
No, I do not. And the reason why is because it's, number one, is I don't want those type of clients.
Okay.
Number two is this is a relationship business, and I would rather have an attorney call me and say, hey, I have a client that really has a problem, and it's a lot easier to deal with than trying to figure out who qualifies for my services. Okay. Because I'm not interested in, if someone calls me, it's fine, but that's not my main focus is professionals who know the value of a tax, good CPA, good forensic accountant, good tax resolution expert, who won't help, okay, versus the person who's got a $10,000 problem they want to make. My fee is not going to justify them trying to get out of $10,000 tax debt.
Okay. All right. So talk to us about your two podcasts that you have.
I started two podcasts. One of them was called the Fraud Fighter Podcast, and that was a podcast that deals with forensic accounting, who's writing out the checks, who's doing the work, and who's doing the training. And those are the questions that I ask. And I interview people in that sphere or that industry. And we just talk about fraud in general, or maybe how to get business as a fraud investigator, that type of thing. The second podcast is called Criminal Tax Files. And that's really just goes over criminal tax from an insider's point of view about how the IRS evaluates a case, goes over a case, why they prosecute certain cases. And it's really me going over my book and explaining what goes on behind the scenes so people understand it's not just a willy-nilly thing that happens with the IRS. There is an intentional, there's 18 months on average on a tax case. This is not something, it's like a parking ticket. An agent only maybe do two or three cases a year. So they're very intense, thought out, typically, hopefully, by the IRS when they actually do prosecute an individual.
Okay.
Before we let you go, my podcast is called Justice Counts. And we typically discuss issues involving justice or injustice. On a grand scale, do you find the tax system, the tax code, a just system? Is there a lot of injustice, or is it typically fair to all citizens and businesses out there in general? What's your assessment from the standpoint of it doing justice?
Code, tax code is what the tax code is. It's Congress making the tax code and the president enforcing it. That's really all it is. Is it a fair tax code? That's not how I would define fair, but society evidently has defined it fair differently than how I would define fair. My definition of fair is everybody pays the same percentage and be done with it. That's just me. There are people that abuse the tax code. And when they abuse the tax code, the government does have a remedy for those who abuse it. It's called prosecution. Ultimately, potentially a prison sentence, as well as getting the assets taken anyways. There's no buying your way out of tax prison. How's that? If you get caught and say, oh, yeah, you're right, I owe $100,000, here's your check, it's not going to stop the prosecution. You can't buy your way out of it. Once you get caught, you're caught. Now the question is, how bad is the damage and what's the judge going to do with you? But there's no closing the case because you pay the tax bill. On a criminal standpoint.
Okay, so you guys, April 15th is coming up. We got to pay our taxes. Let's not have anybody like Robert Nordlander coming after us.
behave yourself, Caddy.
That's right.
Well, I will dare say if there's a criminal investigation going on, typically it's because, like I said, it's not a mistake. It's a pattern of behavior over many years with large dollar amounts.
Oh.
That's what qualifies them for that.
Okay. All right. Robert, thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. We do appreciate it. I think it's been an informative discussion. And Mr. Bellow, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank both of you. That was an interesting conversation.
Thank you, Bob. I do appreciate your time.
Now, just one more break, and I'll be back in a couple of secs with some closing remarks. Hey, guys, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed this podcast and that you'll come back on a regular basis and check out our interviews with guests on topics that I hope you find interesting, entertaining, and enlightening. Our episodes stream weekly every Monday. Let your friends know about this podcast and take a minute to subscribe. Just go to podcast.leantotheleft.net to subscribe. Check out the upcoming interview schedule and listen to all of our episodes. You can also follow us on social media, Facebook at the Lean to the Left Podcast, Twitter at Lean to the Left 1, Instagram at BobGaddy_LeanToTheLeft, and TikTok at Lean to the Left. And you can watch the episodes at YouTube at Lean to the Left. And don't forget to visit our blog site, LeanToTheLeft.net, where you'll find commentary on the news by some excellent writers with progressive perspectives on a whole range of topics. You can sign up as a member there, and of course, it's all free. Now this is Bob Gaddy signing off for Lean to the Left. Thanks for sharing your time with us.